Listening test. Task 1. You are going to listen to a documentary about a famous tennis player. First, you will have 45 seconds to study the task below. Then you will hear the recording twice. While listening, choose the correct answer, A, B, C, or D, for each question, 1 to 8. Put a cross in the correct box on the answer sheet. The first one, 0, has been done for you. After the second listening, you will have 45 seconds to check your answers.
Arthur Ashe had grown up in Richmond, Virginia, in a large extended family. But when he was 6, tragedy struck. His mother died during routine surgery. The young Ashe became withdrawn, retreating into a world of books and of sport. His life as a tennis player, however, began almost by chance.
When I was 10 years old and playing on the courts next to my house in Richmond, Virginia, the tournament director of the Black College saw me playing during an idle moment when the courts weren't being used, and from that moment on, things changed. I mean, if I had been playing baseball during that time, if I'd been doing anything else at all, I may not have done anything else that I did later.
Arthur later won a tennis scholarship to the University of California, and in the 60s became the first black player to be selected for the U.S. Davis Cup team. It was there he met Donald Dell, who captained the team for 2 years. Ashe went on to win both the U.S. and the Australian Open. By 1975, when he met Jimmy Connors in that iconic Wimbledon final, he was 31. Cool, controlled, but already some thought too old to beat the young, brash 22-year-old. The night before the match, Arthur and Donald Dell had dinner together and discussed how he could beat Connors.
Connors was a very, very good competitor.
He was number one in the world at that time.
At that time. He was the longest ranked number one player on the ATP computer for many years. And the next morning, I got up and went downstairs, and I did this a lot in big matches for Arthur. And so I wrote on the back of an envelope, I said, "Dear Lieutenant," when I wanted to get his attention, I would call him Lieutenant, because when he was on the Davis Cup team, he was a lieutenant in the Army. And that was sort of our code. If I said, "Lieutenant," that meant, damn it, pay attention. I wanted to really talk to him. So I wrote him a note and said, "Dear Lieutenant, here are the 4 or 5 things we talked about last night. Just some thoughts. Number one, make sure you get your first serve in and try to serve to his backhand as best you can." Connors was left-handed. So number two, his biggest weakness is a low forehand, so keep the ball low on his forehand side. I just put these 3 or 4 little talking points, I mean literally on the back of an envelope. Arthur goes out to play, and suddenly in the third game, he sits down on the changeovers, which are 90 seconds, and he reaches into his racket cover and pulls out this envelope, and he's sitting there reading it. He looks like he's meditating almost because he focused so much. I knew what he was doing, but the BBC and NBC, both started saying, you know, what is Ashe doing? He's reading these notes. Is he meditating? What's he doing? And the cameras are going crazy because they didn't know. And he won the first set.
Connors did come back in the third set, but in the end, of course, it was Arthur Ashe who took the title. It was the last Grand Slam he would win. 4 years later, Arthur Ashe suffered a heart attack and had to undergo heart surgery. In 1980, he retired from tennis for good. Arthur Ashe had grown up in Richmond, Virginia, in a large extended family. But when he was 6, tragedy struck. His mother died during routine surgery. The young Ash became withdrawn, retreating into a world of books and of sport. His life as a tennis player, however, began almost by chance.
When I was 10 years old and playing on the courts next to my house in Richmond, Virginia, the tournament director of the Black College saw me playing during an idle moment when the courts weren't being used, and from that moment on, things changed. I mean, if I had been playing baseball during that time, if I'd been doing anything else at all, I may not have done anything else that I did later.
Arthur later won a tennis scholarship to the University of California and in the 60s became the first black player to be selected for the U.S. Davis Cup team. It was there he met Donald Dell, who captained the team for 2 years. Ash went on to win both the U.S. and the Australian Open. By 1975, when he met Jimmy Connors in that iconic Wimbledon final, he was 31. Cool, controlled, but already some thought too old to beat the young, brash 22-year-old. The night before the match, Arthur and Donald Dell had dinner together and discussed how he could beat Connors.
Connors was a very, very good competitor.
He was number one in the world at that time.
At that time. He was the longest-ranked number one player on the ATP computer for many years. And the next morning, I got up and went downstairs, and I did this a lot in big matches for Arthur. And so I wrote on the back of an envelope, I said, "Dear Lieutenant," when I wanted to get his attention, I would call him Lieutenant, because when he was on the Davis Cup team, he was a lieutenant in the Army. And that was sort of our code. If I said, "Lieutenant," that meant, damn it, pay attention. I wanted to really talk to him. So I wrote him a note and said, "Dear Lieutenant, here are the four or five things we talked about last night. Just some thoughts. Number one, make sure you get your first serve in and try to serve to his backhand as best you can." Connors was left-handed. So number two, his biggest weakness is a low forehand, so keep the ball low on his forehand side. I just put these three or four little talking points, I mean literally on the back of an envelope. Arthur goes out to play, and suddenly in the third game, he sits down on the changeovers, which are 90 seconds, and he reaches into his racket cover and pulls out this envelope, and he's sitting there reading it. He looks like he's meditating almost because he focused so much. I knew what he was doing, but the BBC and NBC, both started saying, "What is Ash doing? He's reading these notes. Is he meditating? What's he doing?" And the cameras are going crazy because they didn't know. And he won the first set.
Connors did come back in the third set, but in the end, of course, it was Arthur Ashe who took the title. It was the last Grand Slam he would win. 4 years later, Arthur Ashe suffered a heart attack and had to undergo heart surgery. In 1980, he retired from tennis for good.
Task 2. You are going to listen to Emily talking about a job she does in winter. First, you will have 45 seconds to study the task below. Then you will hear the recording twice. While listening, complete the sentences 1 to 8 using a maximum of 4 words. Write your answers in the spaces provided on the answer sheet. The first one, 0, has been done for you. After the second listening, you will have 45 seconds to check your answers.
Hi, my name is Emily Smith, and I'm from Portland, Oregon in the United States. And I'm going to tell you a little bit about my volunteer job in Yellowstone National Park in Montana. Since I live in Portland, I have to get there, so I drive. It's a 14-hour drive. I usually stop in my hometown of Spokane in order to see friends, and then I finish up the next day to get there. It is usually snowy once I get to Idaho and have to go through the mountain passes. It is always snow on the ground when I get to Yellowstone. The coldest winter I had there was minus 40, but usually minus 20 is more typical, but it is definitely cold. So I have to take really, really warm clothes that I don't normally have to use here in rain-soaked Portland. So what my job is, my volunteer job, is taking care of three cabins, which means I check people in when they arrive, make sure that the houses are supplied, and when they check out, I do stripping the beds, all the linens, and I do the laundry, and then I completely clean from top to bottom. During the winter, typically the month of December, they are on private tours, meaning that a group maybe from high school or family, college students, have come to just tour the park and do a special project. And at that time of year, only one road is open into the Lamar Valley. The rest of the park is inaccessible except for by snowcat. And there is the Lamar Valley is flat and has river, but then it goes up into the basalt mountains where sometimes we spot mountain goats in the Lamar Valley. Oftentimes or frequently see buffalo and elk and deer, and I have also seen wolves. I've never spotted them myself. It's always that I see a crowd with their spotting scopes and I say, they've got a wolf in sight. And usually the wolves are quite a ways away. They are not, they're still afraid of the human being, as opposed to the coyotes that will be down the middle of the road and have even stopped traffic by sitting down and resting. They aren't afraid. And at the cabin that I stay in, I often have elk walk by the front or deer in the back, and I've also had bighorn sheep walk through the front. Last year, there were wolf tracks and cougar tracks, and my neighbor came up one day and said, we've got a sighting of a cougar in the yard, so be careful. It's a great volunteer job, and I love it. And I keep saying, well, this is going to be my last year, but I keep going back.
Hi, my name is Emily Smith, and I'm from Portland, Oregon in the United States. And I'm going to tell you a little bit about my volunteer job in Yellowstone National Park in Montana. Since I live in Portland, I have to get there, so I drive. It's a 14-hour drive. I usually stop in my hometown of Spokane in order to see friends, and then I finish up the next day to get there. It is usually snowy once I get to Idaho and have to go through the mountain passes. It is always snow on the ground when I get to Yellowstone. The coldest winter I had there was minus 40, but usually minus 20 is more typical, but it is definitely cold. So I have to take really, really warm clothes that I don't normally have to use here in rain-soaked Portland. So what my job is, my volunteer job, is taking care of three cabins, which means
I check people in when they arrive, make sure that the houses are supplied, and when they check out, I do stripping the beds, all the linens, and I do the laundry, and then I completely clean from top to bottom. During the winter, typically the month of December, they are on private tours, meaning that a group maybe from high school or family, college students have come to just tour the park and do a special project. And at that time of year, only one road is open into the Lamar Valley. The rest of the park is inaccessible except for by snowcat. And there is the Lamar Valley is flat and has river, but then it goes up into the basalt mountains where sometimes we spot mountain goats in the Lamar Valley. Oftentimes or frequently see buffalo and elk and deer. And I have also seen wolves. I've never spotted them myself. It's always that I see a crowd with their spotting scopes and I say, they've got a wolf in sight. And usually the wolves are quite a ways away. They are not, they're still afraid of the human being, as opposed to the coyotes that will be down the middle of the road and have even stopped traffic by sitting down and resting. They aren't afraid. And at the cabin that I stay in, I often have elk walk by the front or deer in the back, and I've also had bighorn sheep walk through the front. Last year, there were wolf tracks and cougar tracks, and my neighbor came up one day and said, we've got a sighting of a cougar in the yard, so be careful. It's a great volunteer job, and I love it. And I keep saying, well, this is going to be my last year, but I keep going back.
Task 3. You're going to listen to a report about a farm in England. First, you will have 45 seconds to study the task below. Then you will hear the recording twice. While listening, match the beginnings of the sentences 1 to 6 with the sentence endings A to H. There is one sentence ending that you should not use. Write your answers in the boxes provided on the answer sheet. The first one, 0, has been done for you. After the second listening, you will have 45 seconds to check your answers.
Farmland itself is different too. Nestling in the Darrant Valley, on the cusp of North Kent and London Commuterland, it's a remade English landscape. When William Alexander began to take over the farm 40 years ago, he's the fourth generation, its 200-year-old heritage was hop-growing. Then UK breweries began to import cheaper hops from Eastern Europe, America, and even China. Nearly 20 years ago, William and his wife Caroline took their diversification gamble and turned their land over to a plant with a different fragrance, lavender. We were looking for ways to use specialist horticultural skills, explains Caroline, as I breathe in the glorious scent from the farm shop with its multifarious products. Castle Farm is part of a small co-op of local lavender producers, and at around 100 hand-weeded acres, it's the largest in the UK with 500,000 plants. That's enough to stretch from London to Sheffield. 80% of the farm's produce is exported outside the European Union. Although the farm sells 25,000 bunches of hand-cut lavender a year, that represents just 2% of the harvest. The premium value lies with the lavender oil, which goes to France. It helps that one of the producer groups speaks fluent French. That's facilitated relationships in Provence with everyone from plant breeders to providers of harvesting machines. Yet this fragrant variant on Coles to Newcastle has come about at a considerable cost to those very farmers in sun-soaked Provence. That's because lavender plants there have been affected by an insect-borne virus. It thrives in the hot Mediterranean climate, Caroline tells me, but fortunately hasn't yet made its way to England. Fingers crossed this insect, the cicadelle, stays on the other side of the channel. French perfumiers have a high regard for the quality of what we produce, adds Caroline, which is just as well, since French visitors could hardly believe their eyes, or their noses, when they encounter the Kentish fields in the full purple haze of high summer, William says. They ask, "How can you grow it in England with all your fog?" He laughs. The lavender harvesters are nearly all local people. Their expert skills ensure the oil can be extracted immediately on site. Pure grade lavender oil is used for aromatherapy and first aid, as well as being sought after by the perfume houses. Lavandin is different. It's another variety of the plant, which produces a stronger, longer-lasting fragrance. It's also mildly camphorous, ideal as a natural insect repellent. It's the one familiar to us from lavender bags, and it's used in household products. It's a stimulant too, inhaled to counteract drowsiness. So the same purple plant is conducive to sleep and to staying awake. But it's the health-enhancing qualities of lavender that particularly interest the Alexanders, including the relief of insomnia and possibly even the symptoms of dementia. For now, their biggest commercial success is a combination of hop oil with lavender. It sells by word of mouth, says Caroline happily. With the harvest now long over, she and William, who's a member of the Royal Geographical Society, prepare to travel to remote terrains, seeking out other plants for possible cultivation. But William retains a fondness for where he was raised. Farmland itself is different too. Nestling in the Darrent Valley, on the cusp of North Kent and London Commuterland, it's a remade English landscape. When William Alexander began to take over the farm 40 years ago, he's the fourth generation, its 200-year-old heritage was hop growing. Then UK breweries began to import cheaper hops from Eastern Europe, America, and even China. Nearly 20 years ago, William and his wife Caroline took their diversification gamble and turned their land over to a plant with a different fragrance, lavender. We were looking for ways to use specialist horticultural skills, explains Caroline, as I breathe in the glorious scent from the farm shop with its multifarious products. Castle Farm is part of a small co-op of local lavender producers, and at around 100 hand-weeded acres, it's the largest in the UK with 500,000 plants. That's enough to stretch from London to Sheffield. 80% of the farm's produce is exported outside the European Union. Although the farm sells 25,000 bunches of hand-cut lavender a year, that represents just 2% of the harvest. The premium value lies with the lavender oil, which goes to France. It helps that one of the producer groups speaks fluent French. That's facilitated relationships in Provence with everyone from plant breeders to providers of harvesting machines. Yet this fragrant variant on Coles to Newcastle has come about at a considerable cost to those very farmers in sun-soaked Provence. That's because lavender plants there have been affected by an insect-borne virus. It thrives in the hot Mediterranean climate, Caroline tells me, but fortunately hasn't yet made its way to England. Fingers crossed this insect, the cicadelle, stays on the other side of the channel. French perfumiers have a high regard for the quality of what we produce, adds Caroline, which is just as well, since French visitors could hardly believe their eyes, or their noses, when they encounter the Kentish fields in the full purple haze of high summer, William says. They ask, "How can you grow it in England with all your fog?" He laughs. The lavender harvesters are nearly all local people. Their expert skills ensure the oil can be extracted immediately on site. Pure-grade lavender oil is used for aromatherapy and first aid, as well as being sought after by the perfume houses. Lavandin is different. It's another variety of the plant, which produces a stronger, longer-lasting fragrance. It's also mildly camphorous, ideal as a natural insect repellent. It's the one familiar to us from lavender bags, and it's used in household products. It's a stimulant too, inhaled to counteract drowsiness. So the same purple plant is conducive to sleep and to staying awake. But it's the health-enhancing qualities of lavender that particularly interest the Alexanders, including the relief of insomnia and possibly even the symptoms of dementia. For now, their biggest commercial success is a combination of hop oil with lavender. It sells by word of mouth, says Caroline happily. With the harvest now long over, she and William, who's a member of the Royal Geographical Society, prepare to travel to remote terrains, seeking out other plants for possible cultivation. But William retains a fondness for where he was raised.
Task 4. You are going to listen to Coretta Scott King, the wife of the famous historical figure Martin Luther King, talking about her life. First, you will have 45 seconds to study the task below. Then you will hear the recording twice. While listening, match the beginnings of the sentences 1 to 6 with the sentence endings A to I. There are two sentence endings that you should not use. Write your answers in the boxes provided on the answer sheet. The first one, 0, has been done for you. After the second listening, you will have 45 seconds to check your answers.
When Coretta Scott was growing up on a farm on the outskirts of Marion, Alabama, she dreamed of a career in music. She had no intention of marrying a minister. She had no inkling that she, alongside her husband, would become one of the country's leading figures in the movement that won civil rights for African Americans. She could not have imagined she'd be an icon worldwide of dignity, of righteousness, and of hope. These were all far beyond the grasp of a young Black girl growing up in Alabama during the 1930s and 40s.
I know something about what it is like to be a young person struggling to succeed against adversity. As an African-American child growing up in the segregated South, I was told one way or another almost every day of my life that I wasn't as good as a white child. When I went to the movies with other Black children, we had to sit in the balcony while the white kids got to sit in the better seats below. We had to walk to school while the white children rode in school buses paid for by our parents' taxes. Such messages saying we were inferior were a daily part of our lives. But I was blessed with parents who taught me not to let anyone make me feel like it wasn't good enough. And as my mother told me, you are just as good as anyone else. You get an education and try to be somebody. Then you won't have to be kicked around by anybody. And you won't have to depend on anyone for your livelihood. Not even a man.
Coretta Scott King was speaking here to an Academy of Achievement gathering in 1999. It was at the National Cathedral in Washington, D.C. She stood at the pulpit, that same pulpit where her husband, Martin Luther King Jr., stood 31 years before to deliver what would be the last Sunday sermon of his life. Coretta told her audience on that day she spoke that she was often asked how she managed to be so involved in the civil rights struggle while raising four children.
I can only reply that when God calls you to a great task, He provides you with the strength to accomplish what He has called you to do. Faith and prayer, family and friends were always available when I needed them. And of course, Martin and I always were there for each other. I learned that when you are willing to make sacrifices for a great cause, you will never be alone because you will have divine companionship and the support of good people. And this same faith and cosmic companionship sustained me after my husband was assassinated and gave me the strength to make my contribution to carrying forward his unfinished work.
Coretta Scott King spoke many times to the Academy of Achievement, and she sat for two interviews in 2003 and 2004. When Coretta Scott was growing up on a farm on the outskirts of Marion, Alabama, she dreamed of a career in music. She had no intention of marrying a minister. She had no inkling that she, alongside her husband, would become one of the country's leading figures in the movement that won civil rights for African Americans. She could not have imagined she'd be an icon worldwide of dignity, of righteousness, and of hope. These were all far beyond the grasp of a young Black girl growing up in Alabama during the 1930s and 40s.
I know something about what it is like to be a young person struggling to succeed against adversity. As an African-American child growing up in the segregated South, I was told one way or another almost every day of my life that I wasn't as good as a white child. When I went to the movies with other Black children, we had to sit in the balcony while the white kids got to sit in the better seats below. We had to walk to school while the white children rode in school buses paid for by our parents' taxes. Such messages saying we were inferior were a daily part of our lives. But I was blessed with parents who taught me not to let anyone make me feel like it wasn't good enough. And as my mother told me, you are just as good as anyone else. You get an education and try to be somebody. Then you won't have to be kicked around by anybody. And you won't have to depend on anyone for your livelihood. Not even a man.
Coretta Scott King was speaking here to an Academy of Achievement gathering in 1999. It was at the National Cathedral in Washington, D.C. She stood at the pulpit, that same pulpit where her husband, Martin Luther King Jr., stood 31 years before to deliver what would be the last Sunday sermon of his life. Coretta told her audience on that day she spoke that she was often asked how she managed to be so involved in the civil rights struggle while raising four children.
I can only reply that when God calls you to a great task, He provides you with the strength to accomplish what He has called you to do. Faith and prayer, family and friends were always available when I needed them. And of course, Martin and I always were there for each other. I learned that when you are willing to make sacrifices for a great cause, you will never be alone because you will have divine companionship and the support of good people. And this same faith and cosmic companionship sustained me after my husband was assassinated and gave me the strength to make my contribution to carrying forward his unfinished work.
Coretta Scott King spoke many times to the Academy of Achievement, and she sat for two interviews in 2003 and 2004.
This is the end of the listening test.